In this lecture, we're going to speak about Rav Sadia Gaon, probably the greatest Gaon in the era of the Gaonim. But let's begin with a discussion of Jewish leadership under Islamic rule. As mentioned in our last lecture, when the Jews were under the rule of the Muslims starting from the 630s, the Muslims established a code of laws by which the Jews and the few Christians who remained in the lands which they conquered were forced to live, called the Pact of Omar. The object of this code was to make it perfectly clear that members of another religious group were inferior to Muslims, but these groups were protected individuals and were not to be physically persecuted, and they were called dhimmis. It should be noted, however, that the regulations contained in the Pact of Omar were not as strict as they might have been, and many of these rules were not enforced too strictly, and before long, Jews were holding high positions of trust and honor under various caliphs. Most important of all for the life of the Jews in Muslim lands was that the new religion permitted Jews to maintain their own communities and live in accordance with their own religious laws under the guidance of the Rosh Gola and the Yeshivot. We also mentioned in the last lecture that there were two different types of Jewish leaders at the time, the Rosh Gola and the Gaon. The Rosh Gola, the exilarch, was the Jewish political leader at the time, and he claimed descent from David HaMelech. The positions was hereditary, and the Rosh Gola carried himself with splendor and majesty. He appointed judges, he had an authoritative say in matters of Jewish law and the organization of yeshivot, and he collected taxes for the caliph. The Gaon was the head of the yeshiva of Sura or Pumbedita, the primary yeshivos in Bavel at the time. He was the ruler on Jewish law, subject to when the exilarch exercised his power. When someone had a question, only the Gaonim were authorized to communicate decisions on both Jewish law and practice to other communities. Now, there were yeshivos in both Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, but the Babylonian yeshivos wielded the most influence. There were two Yarchei Kala, one before Pesach, one before Rosh Hashanah, and during this time, many temporary students would gather at the yeshiva, and it was also a time for discussing and answering the various questions that had reached the yeshivos from the various communities. The questions were posed to the Gaon from across the world, and first other students would analyze it and discuss it in front of him during the Yarchei Kala, that eventually the Gaon would provide the answer. The Gaonim were considered the intellectual leaders of the entire diaspora, and their decisions and responses had absolute legal validity in most Jewish communities. Even though the structure of the Gaonim wasn't like the structure of the Exilarchate, the Rosh Gola, which was handed from father to son, nevertheless, most Gaonim were selected from a very few restricted number of families of Gaonim, numbering 6 in Bavel and 3 in Eretz Yisrael. One Gaonic family traced its descent to the house of David, one to a priestly family, one to a Nasi of Roman times, one to Hillel, Hazakin, and one to Ezra. Therefore, there was a sense of aristocracy in the institution of the Gaonim and the Exilarchate in Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. Rav Sadia Gaon was an exception to the rule, as he was an outsider whose powerful personality and scholarship whose powerful personality and scholarship penetrated this aristocracy as he became the Gaon. Normally speaking, the Gaonim were selected by the Rosh Gola and a group of scholars, but if both sides couldn't agree on the Gaon, then sometimes each side would select its own candidate until a compromise was reached or one of the candidates died. Generally, the Gaonim and the Rosh Gola got along, but occasionally disputes grew between them, the most famous between Rav Sadia Gaon and the exilarch David ben Zakkai in 930, which we will discuss shortly. Again, Rav Sadia Gaon was the greatest scholar and the author of the Gaonic period, and he was the leader of Babylonian Jewry. He lived from 882 to 942. He was born in Egypt. We don't know much about his family or about his teachers, although it seemed that he studied in Eretz Yisrael for some period of time, and some suggest that perhaps he went there because it was the center for the studies of biblical study, and Bavel as opposed to Bavel, which was the center of Talmudic study. However, when Rav Sadia Gaon lived in Egypt. He had already written two books and corresponded with a Rav Yitzchak ben Shlomo Yisraeli of Kairouan, an Egyptian Jewish court physician and philosopher. When Rav Saadia Gaon was 23 years old, he writes a responsum or a refutation of Anan. Who was Anan? So he was the founder of the Karaite movement. A little more than 100 years before Rav Saadia Gaon wrote his responsum, in 765, there was a man named Anan ben David who had a younger brother, Hananya. The younger brother was chosen to be the Rosh Gola instead of Anan. Some say that the Gaonim suspected Anan of two things. Number one, they were afraid that he would try to impose his authority on them to a greater extent than they desired. Number two, they felt he was not completely devoted to Jewish tradition and that, therefore, he might not enforce Talmudic law as the Gaonim and their predecessors interpreted it. After Hananya was chosen, Anan spoke his mind about the Gaonim, the yeshivos, the Talmud, and Jewish tradition, and he was reported to the Caliph, and this was interpreted as a rebellion against the government. Anan responded by saying he wasn't rebelling against Judaism, rather he had a different religion. Anan's approach to deciding law was different than the Gaonim in that he claimed absolute authority for his own personal halacha, and that he was not required to follow the dictates of the Gaonim and the Talmud to decide what he should do from a halachic point of view. In the 9th century, opposition to the established leadership of the Gaonim grew, but it climaxed in the 10th century, and the opposition took on the name Karaites. Some say Karaites is derived from the word Karaim or Biblicists, from the word Mikra, meaning that they were only interested in the Bible and Tanakh and not Torah Shebaal Peh for guidance. In his work, Refutation of Anan, Rav Saadia Gaon fought back against the increasing power of the Karaites, especially in Eretz Yisrael, because many Karaites were experts in Parshanut and led polemics against the oral tradition. What are the primary arguments against the Karaite approach? So he said that the Karaites didn't realize that the traditions of the rabbis were based on careful study on the need of adjusting Judaism to the life of the people at the time. For example, there's not much in the Torah about the preparation of food, so the Karaites had to follow many of the regulations of the rabbis in any case. The Karaites had no fire on Shabbos, so their homes and food were cold. But Jews permitted fire to burn if it had been kindled before the Shabbos began. Additionally, they assumed that every individual has enough knowledge and experience to understand the full meaning of the Torah. Rav Saadia Gaon made fun of the Karaites for having developed traditions to perpetuate their religion, which was the very thing that they started out to abolish. And he pointed out that their traditions were inferior to the traditions set forth by Torah Shebaal Peh, and he landed a blow from which the Karaites never recovered. After the 905 publication of the Refutation of Anan, we hear nothing of Rav Saadia Gaon until 921, when he enters into a struggle with Aaron ben Meir. This is a calendar debate, and the documentation of the dispute was found in the Cairo Geniza documents. See, in 922, ben Meir announced that Pesach that year would fall out on Sunday and not on Tuesday, which was accepted according to the Babylonian calendar, and therefore Rosh Hashanah would follow on Tuesday and not Thursday, and this would affect the fixing of the days of other holidays. Ben Meir also deviated from the accepted practice of midday as the deciding line for the declaration of the new moon. To understand the background of this controversy, originally the Chagim, the Jewish festivals, were fixed by observation of both the sun and the moon. And eventually, certain astronomical rules were used because Roman authorities attempted to stop the Patriarchate from declaring the new month. In Bavel, definitely by the close of the Talmud, observation of the moon was entirely given up, and the complete and final system of the calendar was introduced. This was adopted by all the Jews of the diaspora, and it marked the increasing power of Bavel and the decreasing power of Eretz Yisrael. Now, by the beginning of the 10th century, the yeshivos of Sura and Pumbedisa were weak, and there is infighting between the leading scholars and the Exilarch. Enter Aaron ben Meir, head of the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, who claimed descent from the house of Hillel. Now, the Jewish lunar year consists of 12 alternating months of either 29 or 30 days. Usually Cheshvan is 29 days and Kislev is 30 days, but sometimes both are 30 and sometimes both are 29, resulting in 353, 354, 355 days in a lunar year. Now, this determination of whether these months are 29 or 30 days depends on four rules, and two are important for our discussion. So the first is what's known as Lo Adu Rosh. Rosh Hashanah can never fall out on Adu, Aleph, Dalet, or Vav, on Sunday, on Wednesday, or on Friday. It cannot fall on Sunday, so that Hoshanah Rabbah is not on Shabbos, and it cannot fall on Wednesday or Friday, so that Yom Kippur is not on Friday or on Sunday. That's the first rule. And the second rule is that the new moon must be seen before noon of this particular day. If the moon was visible after more than, or the molad took place after more than 6 hours of the day, let's say on Shabbos, so it would be pushed off to Sunday. And since Sunday, let's say that month was going to be Tishrei, there was Rosh Hashanah, so then Rosh Hashanah won't fall out until Monday. Again, if, let's say, if the new moon, the molad, would be after noontime on Shabbos, and this would be Rosh Chodesh Tishrei, so it would be pushed off a day because of the rule. If the molad is after Chatzos, noon, on a particular day, it's pushed off to the next day. And the next day is either Adu, Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday, so it's pushed off a second day. So that's the molad. The molad, by the way, is what's called conjunction. When the moon lines up with the sun, then that means the moon will become visible the next day. So the molad, again, if the molad is afternoon on one day, so then we push off Rosh Chodesh to the next day. Now, in the year 921, it was anticipated that in 2 years later, the rule of the 2 days postponement would come into operation. Ben Meir took issue with the ruling of the noontime and came to the conclusion that the molad was within 642 chalakim after Chatzos, then no postponement was necessary. Not so clear what the rationale for this was. Maybe he wanted to reduce the number of postponements in the calendar, but his plan became known in the summer of 921 because he said that since the year 4684 was going to be a full year, meaning no postponements, and 4682 can be deficient, and he announced that Cheshvan and Kislev would only have 29-day months in the year 4682, and that meant that Pesach was 2 days earlier. So in Sukkot of 921, news of this proclamation reached the Rosh Golah. David ben Zakkai reached the Rosh Golah, David ben Zakkai, so he sent an urgent letter to Ben Meir warning against changing the already established calendar. Therefore, in 922, Jews in Eretz Yisrael celebrated Rosh Hashanah on Tuesday, and the Jews in Bavel celebrated Rosh Hashanah on Thursday. Because the Jews in Eretz Yisrael followed Aaron ben Meir, they didn't postpone, and the Jews in Bavel did postpone. Eventually, ben Meir lost ground, the Gaonim in Bavel won, and Rav Sadia Gaon was requested to compose a detailed account of the event, which would serve as a reminder to Jews, and he currently wrote Sefer HaZikaron. He also wrote Sefer HaMoadi, which gives a complete account of the dispute. Now, Ben Meir wrote that it was Rav Sadia Gaon who was responsible for his defeat. It seems that on Rav Sadia Gaon's arrival to Bavel in 922, he was appointed to the Yeshiva in Pupadisa as a Reish Kala, or an Aluf. His talents and personality attracted many in Baghdad. By this time, the yeshivos of Sur and Pupadisa were located in Baghdad. When the question of the continuation of the yeshiva of Sur was under discussion, his name was proposed. After the last Gaon had died, it was suggested that the yeshiva be closed down completely and the students would be transferred to Pupadisa. David ben Zakkai decided to maintain the Sur yeshiva. At first, Rav Nasan ben Rav Yehudai Gaon was appointed the Aluf, but he died before he could take office. Most of the Gaonim came from a limited number of families, and it was not easy to deviate from this tradition. Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Sadia was a stranger, not well connected. However, as Natana Bavli, the 10th century historian, reported, quote, although he, Sadia, is a great man and a profound scholar, he is not afraid of any man and does not show favor to anyone because of his great knowledge, eloquence, and piety, end quote. However, his writings against the Karaites and his conflict with Ben Meir demonstrate his fearlessness, his dedication to Torah, and his loyalty to the Rosh Gola. And it was hoped that under his leadership, the yeshiva of Sura would be revived. Sadia was appointed head of Sura in 928, but the Rosh Gola administered the oath to Nu Gaon that, quote, he do not disobey or plot against me or regard anyone but me as the exilarch or associate with any of my opponents, end quote. As Gaon, Rav Sadia attempted to increase the number of students in the yeshiva and to secure the financial needs of the institution, he slowly became the acknowledged leader in Bavel until a bitter dispute took place between Rav Sadia Gaon and the exilarch. Rav Sadia Gaon refused to confirm settlements, the terms of a settlement of a will which would greatly benefit Rosh Gola. At first, the Rosh Gola, David Ben Zakkai, requested that Kohen Tzedek, the head of Pumbedisa, not sign. But when he did sign, Rav Sadia announced his refusal to confirm the inheritance. It was likely a controversial halachic issue. David Ben Zakkai's son came to Rav Sadia Gaon and asked him to sign, and he responded, Lo sakiru panim bamishpat, I cannot take favors in judgment. And just because you're the Rosh Gola, your father's the Rosh Gola, I can't necessarily do something that I feel is against halacha. Eventually, the son got angry and said, if you don't sign the documents, then I will send forth my hand against you. At that moment, Rav Sadia Gaon's students dragged the boy outside the door and locked it. Once the father heard this, he put Rav Sadia Gaon in Chera. David Ben Zakkai quarreled with Rav Sadia Gaon and eventually deposed him, appointing Yosef Ben Yaakov as Gaon. And Rav Sadia Gaon in turn appointed another Rosh Gola, Yoshio Chassan, the brother of David Ben Zakkai, as the Rosh Gola. Natana Bavli, the historian, writes that all the wealthy people in Bavel, the yeshiva students, and the prominent members of the community were on Rav Sadia Gaon's side until 932. He was in a strong position. However, when Caliph Al-Kahir ascended the throne in 932, the Caliph needed money badly, and Aaron Sarhado's contribution helped the Caliph, and Aaron sided with David Ben Zakkai. He was a bitter enemy of Rav Sadia Gaon. In any case, as a result, Yoshio Hassan was banished to Khorasan, which is in northeast Iran, where he died shortly afterwards. Rav Sadia Gaon was forced to relinquish the Gaonate and take refuge from the wrath of his opponents. But during this time, he was free to pursue his creative works, and he wrote Emunot V'Deyot, a very important philosophical work, and a second version of a grammatical work called Sefer HaGalui. Eventually, Rav Sadia Gaon reconciled with the Rosh Golad. He was reappointed to the yeshiva of Surah 937, and to demonstrate that there was complete reconciliation, after David's son Yehuda died shortly after his father in 942, Rav Sadia Gaon raised the son in his very own home. And he made tremendous contributions to halacha. He wrote books on new topics, such as the laws of gifts, commercial transactions. He was the first to write halachic works in Arabic. And he wrote a major philosophical work, Emunot V'Deyot. And he also wrote works on grammar. He was the first to lay down the scientific rules for a systematic treatment of the Hebrew language. He wrote Sefer HaEgron when he was a young man. This is a Hebrew dictionary in two parts. In the first part, all the words are arranged in alphabetical order. The second part, he lists a collection of rhymed word endings, which is a useful tool for poets writing in Hebrew. And he was the first to write a translation for the Tanakh into Arabic, and that work was called the Tafsir. And he wrote down a Sidur, a prayer book as well, And he was one of the dominant figures in the development of Judaism and its literature in so many different varieties. He is certainly the most authoritative Gaonic source.